Tyler problem, I have a question. Process company. When you do the framework, I don't quite get the point when you try to do the derivative thing. Like you have u, what was that? U, d mu, u. You said there's a case we don't have derivative in it, and we have
this
a
thing.
Case where we have derivative in it. Yes.
Yeah.
And I don't quite get your logic why you move on to a derivative case.
Why? I didn't hear the last part of it. Why what?
Why did you go to a derivative case? Like, why did you consider this case?
Oh, because I was looking for something which is going to... The problem was that we had this field chi was transforming to... or two reasons, actually. So one of them was that chi was transforming to gamma times chi, but gamma was a function of position. So that meant that the derivatives of chi were going to do some weird thing, right?
Yeah.
And so the goal was to try and find something else that transforms involving only gamma mm-hmm. in such a way that I can cancel this. So something ideally that would shift by the derivative of gamma.
I see.
But otherwise only involve multiplication by gamma. Okay. And this is and really originally u was going to gu was equal to u twiddle gamma, right? So the thing is, the problem here is the g's, so or u goes to u twiddle, which is g u gamma inverse. So the problem is that u itself is the only thing we have this gamma depends on theta. So we're looking to build something out of theta, which transforms in a way to fix this, and the basic thing we have. That depends on theta is u, but u has this property that it involves g in its transformation rule. And so that's going to be less useful here. But by doing this trick of taking u inverse u, you can get rid of the g's, but you have to differentiate it first, because if I didn't, then u inverse u is just 1, so it's not so useful. But if I differentiate it, then u inverse du it still depends on theta, but it has the property that when I do the transformation, the g's have dropped out, and it only depends on gamma. And then the point of the argument was that, in particular, it also, because of the derivative, picks up a derivative of gamma, and then you can use it to design a covariant derivative here that cancels this term. But it also gives you a piece which is homogeneous, which from which we made the kinetic term for theta.
Yeah.
And so the main thing was this decomposition of this thing in terms of the generators in X and the generators Y, you know, the AI, mu, Ti minus I guess it's plus I, e alpha mu x alpha. So this was possible because of this lives in the Lie algebra, and then these two things were the transforming the way we liked.
So that's another part I was confused, because you say, is that a standard way you can just, because you say you can write it in general, like a linear combination of those, right?
Yeah.
Is that a lemma or something?
Like, yeah.
Oh, okay. So I just have to believe you, right?
Well, you're asking me, yeah, can I prove it?
What?
You know, if I was expanding around 1, you would believe it, right? If I wrote that u was e to the I theta alpha x alpha, so it's, you know, 1 plus I theta alpha x alpha plus order theta squared.
Oh, okay.
Then you would have been happy. And the only issue is why the u here, right? If u was 1, it doesn't make a difference. And
yeah.
the idea is that on these spaces we're looking at, you know, there'll be a specifics. I'm imagining that these u's are labeling, the thetas are labeling where I am on the space. And so it needn't necessarily be true that for any particular theta equals 0 theta equals 0 will correspond to one particular u, which will correspond, let's say, to that point there. But I might be interested in this point over here, which I can get from that one by, for some choice of theta in this u. So let's call it a u naught of theta, which is the thing that takes me to here from here to here. And so then if I wanted to expand around this point, what this is essentially doing is it's removing the, if this expansion applies here, but I'm trying to do an expansion here, then this U naught essentially moves me over to here where I can do the expansion around one. So that's kind of not a proof, but it's kind of a, morally, you could make a proof out of that.
Okay.
I think the way the mathematicians would do it is they just say that, you know, this thing, the space is labeled by the thetas, and then once you differentiate it, then what you're doing is you're picking off the tangent of the space somewhere. And so you're looking at things in the tangent space, and that's where you get to define the Lie algebra. And if you do that at different places, the generators aren't the same, but they're similarity transformations of each other, depending on where you do it. So if you think of the rotation that makes this point invariant, say, it's not the same as the rotation that makes this point invariant. So the H, where it sits inside G, is changing because you're kind of doing a transformation that takes you from here to here, if you're comparing the tangent of the space here to the tangent of the space here. And so these are useful because they transform nicely and they're things that live in the space. And so if I was a mathematician, I'd say, consider the following definition. But the fact that you can write it in terms of the generators is to do with the fact that you're always looking at something infinitesimal, a little infinitesimal direction tangent to the space you're living in. Okay. I don't know if this is helping or hurting.
Yeah.
Okay. Good answer. It's helping or hurting, yeah.
Helping, I think.
Okay. But it's kind of a standard construction for Lie groups if you're trying to.
Okay.
Okay. So I kind of again I didn't get as far as I wanted to get, but I'm trying to get to the point where you see this formalism being used usefully somewhere, and so. Where do I have that now? So I'm set up the problem of in QCD we have we're writing it as being an unperturbed part plus a small part, where the unperturbed part is the stuff involving the gluons about which I'm not really talking, because I'm really interested in how the quark flavors are related to each other. Then there's a kinetic term, I guess it's minus Q bar D slash Q. And then the perturbed part is minus Q bar, and then I'll write it as capital M Q, where M is a matrix, M up, 0, 0, M down, let's say. We'll just follow two quarks just for the sake of it. So Q is U D. And this covariant derivative is got a gauge field in it, but it's not acting on these two indices, U versus D. It's actually acting on the colors that I'm not writing here, that each of these comes in three colors. So there's an SU3 that rotates those colors that's buried in the D slash. And D slash is gamma mu D mu, where D mu is partial mu minus I, some gluon thing. I'm going to call that G just to distinguish it from what I've the other A's we're going to talk about in a second. I think I called that a K. And the idea was that this part of the problem has a scale in it, lambda QCD, which is something like 200 MeV and higher. And this part of the problem has a scale which is set by these masses, so MU and MD are less than 10 MeV, which is much smaller. So in most of the applications that people have in mind where you're looking at protons or things that are built from these ingredients, the energies involved are this or higher. And for those kind of problems, the masses involved of the quarks are really small. And so the picture is we're going to imagine perturbing in these. So we're going to think about this as being our zeroth order system, and we'll perturb around it. And the utility of that was that this has more symmetry than the whole thing does, because the mass term is breaking some of the symmetries. And so since the mass term is small, those symmetries won't be exactly true, but they'll be approximately true. And so the consequences of a symmetry we might look for won't be precisely satisfied. Particles won't be exactly having the same mass if they're related by the symmetry, or there won't be an exactly a Goldstone boson, but it'll be approximately true, in that the particles will be split by small masses, or the Goldstone boson will be light but not massless. And the amount by which the symmetry consequences fail should be calculable in perturbation theory in powers of this, which will be powers of the quark masses. That's the logic of chiral perturbation theory. So even though we can't solve the strong interactions, we can extract some of the symmetry information of QCD to say something about how real, honest to God, pions behave. And the symmetry we're talking about is, I take the quarks, U and D, and they go to some matrix times them. And that matrix, I can write it as being e to the I, say omega left A times Pauli matrix A plus I over 2 omega right A, sorry, times a projection matrix onto left-handed things. Tau A gamma right. I'm going to rewrite this because I'm running too small now, I can tell. So this U, naively I can only write 2x2 matrices here, but what I'm not writing, I'm not writing the color indices, but I'm also not writing the spinner indices. These things are each spinners in the way that you would have had in the Dirac equations. And so this matrix U can act both on the spinner indices and on these indices, the up and downness here. So that's what I'm writing out here. I'm just going to rewrite what I wrote over there. So it's e to the I over 2, some parameter left Pauli matrix times gamma left plus I over 2 parameter times Pauli matrix gamma right, where gamma left is 1/2 1 plus gamma 5. So this is a Dirac matrix, whereas the Pauli matrices are acting in this 2x2 space, the span by the U and D, and gamma right is 1/2 1 plus gamma, 1 minus gamma 5. And the Pauli matrices, you remember, are tau 1 is 0, 1, 1, 0. Tau 2 is 0 minus I, 0. And tau 3 is 1, 0, 0 minus 1. So these guys act on this two-component thing. So E to these guys, if we didn't have the gamma matrices, would have just been unitary transformations that mix the U and the D quark with each other. And these guys are acting on the spinner indices that these two things are carrying that I'm not writing. I could really write this as being U1, U2, U3, U4, D1, D2, D3, D4, where the 1 to 4 is the spin space that the Dirac matrices span, and that's what these guys are acting on. I'm going to use a basis where gamma 5 is you know, 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, and 0 is on the off diagonal. Are you happy with that, everybody? So who's acting on what? You're all happy? Good. All right. It breaks it because if you think about what happens with it, if I took delta quark is let's say I just take a U1 transformation. I have I. If I had let's say Q went to e to the I alpha plus beta gamma 5 Q. Then and where I'm not going to actually worry about the Pauli matrices, just to do it. This is like a U1 transformation. Then Q bar is Q dagger gamma 0, basically. So what happens is I take a dagger, I get a minus sign here, but this is a real matrix. But then when I move this phase past the gamma 0, the gamma 5 changes sign because it anticommutes with the gamma matrices. So gamma 5 with all the gamma matrices is 0, they anticommute. So that means that Q bar, it would have gone to e to the minus But then for the gamma 5, its sign flips again from the gamma 0, so it goes to q bar e to the minus I alpha plus I beta gamma 5. And now if I have a mass term, what happens is that the e to the I alpha hits the e to the minus alpha and goes away. But this guy, I hit it again and I don't have a minus sign, so it doesn't go away. Whereas if the kinetic term, what happens, I got one more gamma matrix in the d slash, because it's gamma mu d mu. And so that extra gamma matrix changes the sign again, and so then I get minus signs on both sides. So what's happening is that the kinetic term, you have a freedom to rotate separately the left and the right-handed parts of the spinners, but the mass term is tying them to each other, so you can't separately rotate them. You have to rotate them together. So that's the chiral part. These taus, they're acting on, no, they're not acting on spin, they're acting, this is the up row and this is the down row. And spin is buried in the gamma matrices.
So, right now when you're talking about up and down, those are bio spinners that you have Dirac?
They are, the way I'm writing it, they're Dirac spinners because I'm writing these as, that's why I'm projecting out left and right separately. So because I'm thinking of the quarks really are direct. I could have done it where I followed the left-handed quark and then the left-handed anti-quark, which would be the right-handed quark. But I'm assembling them together into a Dirac spinner. So I'm thinking of this as being an honest-to-God Dirac spinner because they have charge. And if I wanted to then pick out the left and right-handed parts, that's what these things are doing. They're picking out the left and right-handed parts. And I'm working in a basis where because this is diagonal, the top is left-handed and the bottom is right-handed in the 4x4 spinner space.
So if you went to like Dirac basis or the slowly moving basis, your mass matrix would go off-diagonal?
In this basis, it's off-diagonal already because of the gamma matrix. The non-relativistic one is one where gamma 0 is diagonal rather than gamma 5. And so
is your mass matrix diagonal or not diagonal?
Mine would not be if you concluded the gamma zero that's in gamma q bar, it's not diagonal because I've got a gamma zero in it and that's not diagonal for me. Whereas it would be in the non-relativistic phases.
So up and down are the SU2 double is that the idea?
Yeah. Well, it's not. That's the thing. That's why I'm confusing you. That SU2 that you're talking about, the up and down, is this one that these Pauli matrices are acting in. But these are not. These are constants. I'm talking about rigid rotations here, because when I differentiate Q, I'm going to take that the derivative doesn't really differentiate these guys. But the gauge group that was in the gluon thing, that thing, is being there's even another index I haven't talked about. It's neither spin nor up and down, which is color. So that each of these things, for each spin, for each flavor, there's three colors. And that's what this is acting on. So really, if I wrote everything out, this would be a 3 times 2 times 4 is 24 component thing. And so the color is acting in a kind of a three-dimensional piece of that. Spin is acting in a four-dimensional piece of that. And the flavor is this up-downness is another two-dimensional piece of that. And they're all separate. And I'm never going to talk about the colors again, so I just tell you it's there because that's what the interactions are. But then we will never talk about it again, that's why I'm not writing it. So you can effectively forget that it's there and just think about the spin and the up down. Yeah, the chiral part is if I only had this, if I'd stopped here and didn't write any of that, and I just had that would be SU2. And so now what's happening is that if I think of now, if I wrote this as being U left, U right, D right, say, or I guess it might have been better to write it as U left, U right, D left, D right. So now I'm writing the two-component spinner and two-component spinner. Then what would happen is that this is saying that this guy and this guy get rotated with this phase, and this guy get rotated with this phase. Because of these, that's what these gamma matrices are doing. but they're independently being rotated. So that's the chiral part of it. I'm not rotating them both together. And that will be when I rotate them together, that'll be the vector part of it. And when I rotate them oppositely, that'll be the axial part of it. And the argument is going to be that the vector part of it, where they rotate together, is a symmetry. And it really is true that particles come in multiplets of an SU2, which is isospin, which protons and neutrons are almost the same mass. Pions are almost the same mass, all three types. And the axial one, where they go oppositely, that's the one that's spontaneously broken. And so that's the one where you're getting a Gleason boson. So the idea is that we really actually have a U2 cross U2, but I'm going to focus on the SU2 parts of things. So we've got SU2 left cross SU2 right is our group G. And the thing that's unbroken, I'm imagining that the ground state has the property that Q bar Q, which another way of writing that would just be, you know, U bar U plus D bar D. That's not zero. And so we've broken a symmetry. And the symmetry this breaks will be, this is invariant under the part where I rotate these guys together, left and right. When omega right is equal to omega left, so there's no gamma fives, then this is like a mass term, it would be invariant. But the gamma five things, when this is the opposite sign to that, which would give me a gamma five, that this is not invariant under that. And so this being non-zero says the vacuum cannot be invariant under axial transformations. So the H will be what I'll call SU2 vector. And that's the one, what that means is it's the subgroup defined by omega left is equal to omega right. Because that's the one where there's no gamma fives here. Because if I take this as equal to this, I have gamma left plus gamma right as a common factor, but gamma left plus gamma right is 1. And the axial is the difference. If I took this to be minus this, that would be the axial one, right? So H is e to the I over 2 omega vector A tau A, period. So to apply the formalism, I want to write the matrix U, because that's the thing, the U of theta. And for that, it's not so interesting to keep the gamma lefts and gamma rights around. So to build the Goldstone boson, Lagrangian, let's define U. I just want to abstract out the group part of this. So I'll take U to be, you know, U left of theta, 0, 0, U right of theta. So this whole thing is a 4x4 matrix. And these are 2x2 matrices that I get by exponentiating these factors without the gamma 5. So U left will be e to the I over 2 theta A tau A. And U right, if I've been writing a group here, let me write it as a group, not as a function of theta. Let's start writing G. So let's write this as G left, G right. So then G left would be e to the I omega left A tau A. And G right would be e to the I over 2 omega right A tau A. So they're just little 2x2 unitary transformations. And I'm just writing them in this in this product form to emphasize that it's a product group. We've got the group is SU2 left acting on different things than SU2 right. And in this language, H would be, you know, G vector 0, 0, G vector. So it would be the same matrix in both slots here, where G vector is e to the I over 2. So with that statement, now we can write out what U is. So U of theta, I'm supposed to take G, but I'm supposed to take just the broken generators, right? That's what I should be doing. And so that means I should be living not in H. So I want to take these guys to be opposite. So I want to write it as U of theta, 0, 0, U inverse or U dagger. So U inverse. So where U of theta is this 2 by 2 e to the I over 2 theta A tau A. So this is now just a 2 by 2 matrix. And I've got the inverse here because I wanted to keep only the generators that were broken. And so I want the ones that are the differences of these guys rather than the where they're equal to each other. And so I want to have, if I have gamma left minus gamma right, that'll have a gamma 5 in it. So that says that the left and right-handed rotations are opposite to one another. Right? You're all happy?
Given that there's still a symmetry around, is there, I mean, this is clearly the nicest choice, but is there an arbitrariness in choosing? Could you just add any part of the original symmetry to how you're parameterizing it?
It's not unique. It's unique up to field redefinitions. So you can always, you know, change variables to make the transformations look different. But the idea is that you can always get to this transformation from the one that you, if you had a different one, you could make the, as long as you're looking at this symmetry breaking pattern, if this breaks to this, the Goldstone bosons, there will be, you know, there's a total of three generators here, three generators here, so we've got a six-dimensional group. And there's three generators that are unbroken, so there's three broken generators.
Yes, yeah, so is there like a notion of the orthogonal generators? I guess like you're picking a basis of three generators that you could add.
Oh yeah, no. You have some freedom to redefine your generators, and in particular the x's. If I added a piece of the t's to it, then it would still have the property that it doesn't annihilate the ground state. And so you just choose your favorite basis, and I'm just choosing one. And what will happen normally is that if you start taking linear combinations of bases, then all the structure functions, you get linear combinations of them, and none of the formulas I showed really relied on that, because in the end of the day, the trace, you know, the action was the trace of these matrices. And then in that trace, you're going to get a sum of kinetic terms. And what, if we had taken a linear combination of bases, that would be like when I give you the answer, you could take the thetas and you could do linear combinations of them when you're finished. And that would give you a different metric. And it's kind of a coordinate transformation of the previous metric. And so the statement would be, just like it would be for general relativity, when we find our kinetic term for our Goldstone-Boson Lagrangian, we're going to get it in a particular set of coordinates. But if you change coordinates, you'll get it in a different set of coordinates. The important thing is that it's invariant under these two transformations. And so the statement, the geometrical statement, would be that the Lie derivative of these two, of these three generators, six generators, I guess, on G alpha beta is going to be zero. And that's true in all coordinates. So I'll have a C for all the everybody in G, but the non-trivial ones will be the three that are in the coset, the ones that were generated by X, because they're the ones that actually move you around the space. And then the other three are ones that are kind of rotating you at a point. So, well, they have the information. So if you think of the sphere again, the metric on the sphere had to be, it was homogeneous, so that the two generators that move you around the sphere didn't change anything. So all points were the same, essentially. But it was also isotropic, in the sense that if I took a rotation around that point, I got the same thing, no matter how I looked. And so that's what the H is doing. It's rotating it. OK, so here's this. And now what I want to do is I want to crank away. And I want to construct, you know, U-twiddle. I wanted to construct the transformation rules. And the reason I'm going to be able to do it analytically is that you know, the Pauli matrices have this property that if I take e to the I anything times the Pauli matrix, that's equal to the cosine of alpha plus I times the sine of alpha times alpha hat, or alpha hat A Pauli matrix A, where alpha is the square root of alpha 1 squared plus alpha 2 squared plus alpha 3 squared. Actually, I guess I wrote the ones alpha 1 squared, alpha 2 squared. I'm writing them as superscripts, not subscripts. So it's like the length of the vector. There's three of these things. Think of it being a vector. If I wrote that as alpha dot tau, then that vector, its norm is alpha. And then alpha hat is the unit vector. It's alpha divided by the norm. So there's this identity going on behind the board that whenever you have an exponential of something, you can write it explicitly in terms of the Pauli matrices without exponentiating. And so I'm going to use that everywhere. And that makes me, that makes it, so now what I can do is I can be completely explicit about this transformation rule. So if we want to know what the rule is for theta, what's theta twiddle? It's some function of theta and g. Well, here's g, here's u, and the rule I'm supposed to use is I take g, multiply it by u, I decompose that as something in the broken space, something that looks like this, times something that lives in h, which is something that looks like this. And with this, apply this rule, if I use this identity in all of these matrices, they all involve 2x2 matrices, so I just go to town. Let me just tell you the answer. All right, so you know that u twiddle will be the same thing with twiddles everywhere, and gamma is going to be this, so I'm going to write it as, you know, e to the I over 2, what I called u times tau a, 0, 0, the same thing here, e to the I over 2 u tau a. So I'm going to tell you what u is. Do it over here. Yada, yada, yada. All right, so if you think of theta alpha goes to theta twiddle alpha, which is theta alpha plus c alpha. So this is like delta alpha. C, I'm going to write it as a vector because I've got three of them, and I'm going to just write them all at once. So that's going to be theta cross omega vector. Remember what that is. That's the unbroken guy has a parameter omega vector. This is the cross product. Plus, I'm going to need more room probably on the board here. Well, let me just keep on going. Plus theta over 2 times tan of theta over 2 plus cotangent of theta over 2 times omega axial. So this is omega axial is the, is if I could have written this as so the axial group is if omega left is equal to minus omega right, that combination is what I'm going to call omega axial. In the same way that if omega left was equal to omega right, I call that the omega vector, wherever I did that. Here. So I'm, instead of giving you omega left and omega right, I'm giving you omega axial and omega vector. This minus theta hat, the unit vector, theta hat dot product with omega axial, close bracket, plus theta hat times theta hat dot omega axial. So that's the explicit formula for the transformation rule for theta that you get by identifying u twiddle here. And the u, this u here, is given by u is omega vector plus theta hat cross omega axial times the tan of theta over 2. So it has the features that I told you should expect to see. It has the feature, except for one of them, what's the... Yeah, so what's not obvious here, if I linearize this, let me write a note. Leave myself some space. If I expand this thing in powers of theta, there should have been a shift here somewhere, right? And that shift is hidden in here. We should be able to see that. So as theta gets small, what's happening is that tan theta is going to 0, cotangent theta is going like 1 over theta. And that theta and this theta are canceling each other for theta small and giving you something which is just omega with no shifts. So if I take the small theta limit of this, it becomes omega axial from that term, plus the next term is theta hat cross omega axial times 10 theta over 2. Oh, sorry, plus, sorry. That's a vector plus order of theta squared. So that's what I get by Taylor expanding this out. And then the formula for u is what I wrote before. Omega vector plus theta hat cross omega axial times 10 theta over 2. And if I expand that out, that's omega vector plus theta cross omega axial over 2 plus order theta squared. And this is not theta hat, this is theta. So it shows you that the algebra can be done, and it has the properties that I gave you before, that for the broken generators, you're shifting the thetas, so that's a sign they're broken. But under the unbroken generators, the thetas transform linearly into, the linear part is a kind of a rotation of the broken generator, of the thetas by the unbroken generators, so it's a linear transformation. And I told you in general that the unbroken transformation is always a linear transformation, so none of this stuff involves omega vector. Same thing here. That the if omega axial were 0, so we're looking at something in H, then u is just omega vector. That was the statement that this gamma just becomes a theta independent H transformation. But there's also a nonlinear transformation to do with the axial part. So all the things that were happening in general are happening here, but it has the advantage that it's an explicit function.
Question.
Yep.
Is the top line the omega of axial or vector?
Which one here? This one here?
Very last omega.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that should have been an omega axial. Thank you. The theta without anything is the length of the vector. Yeah, so it's the same notation I'm using as for the alphas over here. Hat means unit vector, and something with no arrows or hats is the length of the vector. I owe you guys a nickel again. You have to come here to Perimeter and collect. I should have actually paid off to Alex the other day. All right, so then the next thing I have to do is I have to build a gauge field. So I have to construct, do this thing U inverse D mu, U is equal to minus I AI mu, or AI alpha, partial mu theta alpha TI, and I had, in fact, I'm going to actually do it differently here because I'm going to choose a different convention for the I's. Oh, excuse me. Yeah? This is the thing, the parameter that's in the gamma. Gamma was the E to the, it was 2 by 2 matrices. It was E to the I over 2 U times the generator.
Okay.
I was calling that U sub I, U upper I before for the unbroken guys. So let me just define the notation the way I'm going to give it to you, because otherwise I'll get it wrong. So this is going to be basically I over 2 curly A vector mu dot the Pauli matrices in this form, 0, 0, Pauli matrix. So this is the thing that, this was supposed to be living in the unbroken group, so I have the same generators in both diagonals, splots. And then I have the other guy, which is the broken guy, and I'm going to call that E mu. So Pauli matrix 0, 0 minus Pauli matrix. So that's my definition, right? That's what I mean by A and E. And I'm guaranteed that these guys will transform in this nice way. So I can plug everything in and just read off what they are. And so curly A as a function of theta turns out to be minus 2 sine squared theta over 2 divided by theta squared times theta cross d mu theta. And E turns out to be partial mu theta 1 minus, oops, sorry, partial mu theta times sine theta over theta minus sine theta minus theta over theta cubed. Theta dot partial mu theta times theta. So if you expand that out in powers of theta, this first one becomes minus 1/2 theta cross d mu theta plus order theta to the fourth. It has to be even powers of theta here, because if I take theta goes to minus theta, this is even, and this is even. So the next term will be theta to the fourth. And the same way, this is all odd under theta goes to minus theta. This is even, but so then there's that's odd. This is even, and so that's odd. So if I expand that out, that'll start off as d mu theta 1 minus theta squared over 6 plus dot, 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 plus 1/6 theta dot d mu theta times theta. And this will be, the correction will be order theta to the fifth. Let me raise that where you can see it. So it's very explicit functions, and so we can plug that in. Now we have the e's. We can write down the covariant derivatives if we like, but we can also write down the metric. And so the metric will be, so there are invariant Lagrangian for the Goldstone bosons. So L Goldstone boson is going to be, where are we here? So let me tell you in steps. It'll be the metric I'm going to write down, which is going to be a 2x2 metric, as a function of theta, will be delta mn 1 minus theta squared over 3 plus 1/3 theta m theta n plus order theta to the fourth. And I've given it to you backwards. Let me give you the thing I was expanding for that. That was delta mn sine squared theta over theta squared plus theta m theta n theta squared minus sine squared theta over theta to the fourth. And our Lagrangian is now minus 1/2 times f squared gmn of theta d mu theta m d mu theta n plus higher derivatives. Plus couplings to other fields, potentially. And so as advertised, there's one number in this Lagrangian that's not dictated by the symmetries, and that's f, because the functional form of the metric was completely governed by this fact that it had a isometry group that allowed you to translate everywhere in the space and not change the geometry at all. So only parameter is f. If I know what f is, I can tell you how these guys will scatter from each other at low energies. And if I was to calculate some sort of a scattering process, I'd want to canonically normalize the fields. And so the pion fields, the canonically normalized fields, call it pi, that'll be theta times f, right? So f has dimensions of mass. The Lagrangian had to have dimensions of mass to the fourth. Theta, the way I've been using it, is an angle, so it's dimensionless. The derivative is a mass, and so we've got two of them, so that's mass squared. So this f has to be mass to get the dimensions right. And so what I want to do is, if I expand this out in powers of theta, it starts off as being, you know, something independent of theta plus theta squared stuff. So that first term will be the kinetic term for an expansion near theta equals 0. And so that term will be canonically normalized if I write f theta and call that pi, because then we have minus 1/2. So the Lagrangian would be minus 1/2 d mu pi dot d mu pi plus interaction terms, which I'd get by expanding now all these things out in powers of f pi over f. And let me write the first one. So the first one is minus 1 over 2 f squared pi dot d mu pi times pi dot d mu pi plus order pi to the fourth d pi d pi. And so in terms of the canonical field, you see that it's doing, now it's doing what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to be, we have a scalar field. It has interactions. Those interactions are all getting weak at low energies because they're all derivatively suppressed. But how low is low? It's low compared to F, basically. So in this series expansion, what's happening is that once I canonically normalize everything and I write theta is pi over F, then I'll have a kinetic term. But then 1 over F is appearing in front of all the powers of pi. And so it's the thing that's playing the role of the big scale. If I thought of this as an effective Lagrangian, I got by integrating something out. No, I didn't say that. So if for an abelian symmetry, that was true. So if the symmetry was literally shifting, theta goes to theta plus constant, then the whole Lagrangian had to be built out of derivatives of theta. Yeah, the reason you know there's no constant piece is precisely because you go back right to the very beginning of the construction. The U's were defined as I take a field and I do a symmetry transformation on them, but I do a field-dependent one. So if I made the field constant, then that really was a symmetry and the whole Lagrangian doesn't depend on it. So I'm guaranteed by the way that that's why the thetas were defined that way, is that they had the property that if I made theta constant, I've now, what they are is a symmetry transformation of the other field, chi. But because it was a symmetry, now nothing depends on them. Yeah. It is true that if the derivatives were zero, then there's no interactions here.
Yeah.
So all the interactions are proportional to derivatives divided by F. And so that doesn't say that every field has to be, the power of derivative that comes with the interactions is not, in the case we did the toy model, every field came with a derivative. And so that if I have more and more fields, I have more and more derivatives. And that's not true in this case. In this case, all the lowest order interactions are quadratic in the momentum, even if I have 15 pions.
And you don't know that beforehand.
Well, that's what the symmetries told me. See, so that's showing you that if I had done the current algebra correlation functions of this non-abelian group, I would have learned different properties of the S matrix than I would have gotten from an abelian correlations of an abelian current. And the Lagrangian is just building it in for you for free because the content of this Lagrangian came from the shape of the metric, and that was completely dictated by the symmetry transformations that I had built into it, that it had to have this symmetry, and that was just the symmetry breaking pattern that we started with. So any theory at all that has this symmetry breaking pattern, SU2 cross SU2 goes to SU2, will have the Goldstone bosons that interact in this way at low energies. Because this is the content of the current algebra for the low at low energies. But it's much easier to see it here than it was using the current algebra. No. I'm thinking of Minkowski, but I didn't need to commit myself. I could have done Euclidean. What are you thinking about?
Your Lagrangian over here is the metric times derivative
of the field, right? Oh, you're talking about the signature of this metric.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is not the space-time metric. This is the metric on the target space.
So I'm just
curious, basically. This is definitely Euclidean signature, because that's the statement that the kinetic energies for these. For these theta fields are all positive.
Yeah.
And if I had a sign in this metric, then one of the fields would have a negative kinetic energy, and then that's kind of an instability, because I can lose as much energy as I want by making that field vary as quickly as I want. So one of the starting points was I had to require that this metric, and this thing in front of the kinetic terms was positive definite, and that's why it was a metric, not just a two-dimensional tensor. That is this one. I'm just literally writing this out. But what I'm doing is I'm now, instead of writing in terms of theta, I'm writing theta is pi over F.
Okay, my bad. Right. Okay, so you're just putting G and then into the, okay.
And then I'm grouping terms so that I don't separately have pi hats and pies, and you can group them all that way.
Okay.
So there is a, there's an algebra step that goes into that, but it's literally take this and stop at order theta to the fourth. So if you only knew what f was, everything else is a prediction, is the thing. And then the good news is you know what f is. So given f can predict all scattering cross sections at lower energy. At low energy.
There's only one unknown coefficient here and not one big scalar.
Right, only one, exactly. Oh, sorry, the only one, if I put the four derivative terms, there'd be more. But at low energies, they're going to be, if I did the power counting like I did for general relativity, the dominant piece is all coming from the two derivative terms. So those will be there, and they'll complicate at higher energies. They'll start to complicate things more and more. But at lowest energies, it's all coming from this term. And then there's only one parameter. And so the leading... Yeah, because if you remember what happened for gravity, when we asked what was the dominating at low energies, the rule was we were doing trig interactions involving only the two derivative parts of the Lagrangian, and that was the Einstein action. And so the thing that was nice there, that was just classical gravity was dominating graviton scattering. Verbatim, the same thing, if you applied it to this Lagrangian, would tell you that the leading contribution to these particle scattering will be tree graphs where you bake your vertices only from this two derivative piece of the Lagrangian. And if you wanted to go to subdominant order, you do loops of these, one loop of this, plus tree graphs where I include precisely one four derivative interaction. And this is non-renormalizable in the same sense that gravity is, because this all the interactions have one over f's in them, so it's got the coupling has dimensions of one over a mass. And what will happen is that loops of these things will diverge, and the divergence cannot be renormalized into f, but they can be renormalized into these things that you'd be putting in the tree level four derivative interactions, just like for gravity. But at low energies, it's all this, and so it's all one number. And the fact that it's all given by one number is what's called the soft pion theorem. So the fact that you know the S matrix at small momentum in terms of one number, and that number is actually a known number, I'm going to give it to you in a second, is the power of the symmetry. And any Goldstone boson will have an analog of that soft pion theorem, which is telling you that the symmetries are telling you what this lowest interaction term is, and that's telling you what the scattering will be at low energies. So how do you figure out what f is? You might think that you do one scattering and then you learn everything else, but you don't even have to do that. There's another way to get f. We learn, and that's the way we learn that is actually if you go back to the standard model, we've been talking just about the strong interactions here, but pions also take part in the weak interactions, and it happens that the pions decay because of a piece in the standard model that looks like this. So pions, pi pluses and pi minuses decay because of an interaction, of a weak interaction, which looks like, depends on how you want to write it. You can either write it as, it's something like up bar down. There's a coefficient g over root 2, and I guess there's a 1 plus gamma 5, gamma mu 1 plus gamma 5 d. And then there'd be a W boson here, if you like. But at low energies, I can replace that by what this thing decays into, which would be a muon. So there'd be something like a mu bar. Let's call this something else, called gamma alpha. 1 plus gamma 5 neutrino. So this describes, in the standard model, this describes a process where a D quark gets destroyed, it creates a U quark, and in the process emits a W boson, which then decays into a muon and a muon neutrino. So this would be the process where you have a D quark, turns into a U quark. It emits the charge of a D quark is 2/3. The charge of an up quark is a minus 1/3. I got that backwards, probably, actually. That's minus 1/3. That's 2/3. Two D quarks and an up quark is a neutron, and so that had to be neutral. So that's two of those, and that's zero. two up quarks and a down quark is a proton, and that's be 4/3 minus 1/3 is 1. So that means this emits a W minus particle, which then decays into a mu minus and an antineutrino. That's what this is describing. If I kind of collapse that down into an effective spot interaction, then I would get this. But the important thing is that this combination, if I went back to QCD and asked what are the currents for these symmetries, that combination is one of the currents for this SU2 cross SU2 symmetry that I probably erased here now. Yeah, here. So if I take this symmetry acting on the quarks, and I go to the QCD Lagrangian, the Q bar D slash Q Lagrangian, and ask what's the current, the Noether current for the symmetry, it's essentially this. This is the UD, it's the part of the current which is if you think of SU2, there's a third component of angular momentum, and there's a plus minus rather than a 1 and a 2 component. This is the plus thing. I guess it's the minus. It's the one that goes from it's a plus. It goes from D, takes a D and makes it into an up. So it's the matrix 0, 1, 0, 0 generator. And so that guy, there's also plus a complex conjugate is what makes the whole thing. This is just a number. So this is just one of the things that's within our SU2 group, and it has a vector part and an axial part. So this is a linear combination of the generator that goes with this guy, J alpha vector plus J axial alpha for the SU2 cross SU2 symmetry. Or you can think of this as the left-handed current, because this combination is a left-handed guy. So that means that the matrix element of this thing, what we're going to want to do to calculate, so pi on, it turns out a pi plus, or pi minus, I guess I want to have, let's take a pi plus. A pi plus is a combination, it's a D quark and an it's a U quark and an anti-D quark. So it's a U D bar. So that has charge plus 1. It's got a 2/3 plus a 1/3 if it's an antiquark. So the way that pions decay is through this process. I start off with a U quark. Instead of thinking of a D quark turning into a U quark plus a muon plus an antineutrino, what's happening is instead I've got an anti-U quark plus a D quark is going to a muon and an antineutrino. And these were the pions. So if I have a U quark and an anti D quark going into a W particle, and then that goes into a muon and an anti neutrino. If I calculate the rate for this, it's going to involve the matrix element where I start with the vacuum, and I take the matrix element of the quark operator I got here, U bar, gamma alpha, gamma left D. Sorry, I want to start with a pion. Start with a pion. Pi minus, I guess. Pi plus. And I go to the vacuum. So that matrix element will be part of, in perturbation theory, when I take the, if I calculate this graph, you know, the initial state is a it really should have been a U bar D, but really I had a pion. So I had the particular combination of U bar D that's living in a pion. And I'm going to want to evaluate that matrix element. And in QCD, that's the hard part. The matrix element of this would be that I'd want the matrix element of starting with the ground state, the vacuum, and then ending up with a muon and an antineutrino, and I can just calculate that because these guys are all weakly interacting. But here what's hard is calculating the matrix element of a pion with the vacuum of this operator of quarks, because the pion's a complicated thing when written in terms of quarks. But the beauty of it is that at low energies, if I think of this in terms of if I want to ask how does this interaction work in the effective theory built out of these pions, the way to do it is simple, because all I have to do is I have to identify this current. The same symmetry that gave me the current also exists in the effective theory. If I do Noether's prescription for the symmetry in this theory, I can write down what the current is as a function of the pion fields. And then what I need to be doing is I want to be writing the weak interactions expressed in terms of pion fields. I should be using the current for the pion fields instead of this combination, and then multiply it by this and this coefficient, and that'll be telling me in this effective theory what the interaction is that is responsible for pion decay. Are you all with me? So if I can calculate what the Noether current is for the same symmetry as a function of these variables, then what I'll do is I'll write the weak interaction term in the Lagrangian as being that current. So the logic is in the standard model, in the ultraviolet theory, the weak interaction can be written as GF over root 2 times a current. Let me write it as J mu A times this thing involving, and let's say J nu times mu bar gamma nu 1 plus gamma 5. Lambda. So that's what the interaction is in the full theory. In the effective theory, I should use the same thing, but the expression I use for the current will be different. It'll be built into the variables that are appropriate to low energies. So in the effective theory, L weak will have to be G Fermi over root 2 times J. I want J for that particular current there, lambda. Let me write it as curly J, mu bar gamma lambda 1 plus gamma 5 nu, where here J lambda is the current for the generator, tau 1 plus I tau 2, plus or minus I tau 2, whichever one gives me the matrix. I guess this must be plus I tau 2, 0, 1, 0, 0. And so what I'm supposed to use here is J lambda, which is the same current, but now built from the pis. And the way I find it is the Noether prescription, the way I found it here. I just take this Lagrangian, it has a symmetry, what's the current for it? So the question I need to answer now is what's the Noether current for that symmetry? Well, for this particular one, this is actually a broken symmetry. This is it has an axial piece and it has a vector piece over here. Right, it's got an axial piece and a vector piece. The vector piece is the unbroken one, and the axial piece is the broken one. And it's the axial one that's going to be important, because what we're asking for here is a matrix element between a Goldstone boson and the vacuum, and it'll be the broken current that contributes, not the vector one. But if either one contributes, that'll be the thing that gives me the answer. The way that you would have said that in QCD was you'd say that this is a vector and this is an axial vector, and the pion has got parity minus 1, and the vacuum is parity invariant. So the only thing that contributes because of parity invariance is the gamma 5 term. But another way of slicing the same thing is that the Goldstone boson was parity odd because of this was a current, the broken current was an axial current. So, but we can find them both. So we need current for SU2 cross SU2 using the Noether procedure in the pion Lagrangian. And let me just tell you what the answer is, because we're running out of time. And that turns out to be, so the vector current, so the vector here means I'm giving you all three. This is the vector in isospin space, the same way that was pion was a vector. And this is the space-time index, mu. That's minus pi cross d mu pi plus I over 2, all right, no, forget that, plus things involving more powers of pi. And then the axial current is F times d mu pi plus terms involving, this is involves order pi cubed, and this is plus terms involving order pi squared. Actually, this is going to be pi to the fourth, and this will be pi cubed. So what we're supposed to do is take this plus this, take the particular combination 1 and 2 that corresponds to raising from a down quark to an up quark. And you see what's going to happen is that the, and then we want the matrix element between the pion and the vacuum. But those matrix elements are easy in this language because these things just create pions, whereas the quarks created quarks. And so it was harder to know what the matrix element was there. And so this one involves two pions, so it's going to have a zero matrix element between the pion and the vacuum. But this one has only one pion. And it's the guy that's going to survive. And so we'll get a matrix element which is proportional to F. And so by measuring the muon lifetime, we can measure F. Because this other constant, G, that's appearing in the Lagrangian, is measured in other decays like muon decays.
So we're taking the matrix element of the vacuum, this current, and then the end state is neutrino and all that.
Yeah, so we're saying that in the Lagrangian, we have this. I now use this thing here. Here. And then I'm going to want to calculate for the process of pi plus goes to mu, as I say, pi minus goes to mu minus mu bar. I want to calculate in perturbation theory, I'm looking at the mu minus nu bar matrix element of L weak, pi minus. This is what I would have done in both QCD and in this theory with pions. In QCD, what happens is that in the lepton sector, it's a vacuum, this thing, and this thing, and that's something I calculate. And the QCD side of it is I got pion, bunch of quark things, and then the vacuum in QCD, and that's the matrix elements that's hard. But now what we do is we want the same matrix element if we're calculating the same process in the theory with pions, but now we have to calculate. The thing that will be appearing between the pion and the ground state here will be this is the thing involving pions, and that's the formula for it because that's the Noether current. And so there's no parameters involved that are different because the Noether current is completely dictated by the Lagrangian and the symmetry transformation laws. And so so this thing will be given, it's going to use the matrix element vacuum F d mu pi minus. And that's going to be something involving the momentum of the pion. It'll be proportional to F times the momentum of the pion times some number, like 2 pi or something like that. And so I plug that into this, crank away, and I get the decay rate. And then by comparing that to observations, then we learn what the value of F is. It's just because this is something which acts only on the pions, and this is something that acts only on the muons in the neutrino. So when I do the matrix element, I've got some sort of a creation operator for a pion on the right-hand side.
Okay.
It doesn't care about any of these guys, but it hits this guy.
Okay.
And so in the end of the day, the only part of the matrix element that's really playing any role for pions is that one. And same thing for muons and neutrinos. They don't care if I have the destruction operators here or the creation operators here. They don't care about the pion, but they see these guys.
Right.
Yeah, it's the whole thing is a sandwich between the initial and final state, but the hadrons are doing one thing and the leptons are doing the other thing, and they don't care about each other. They would at higher orders in perturbation theory, but at this order they don't. So let me just cut to the chase, write the answer, and Bob's your uncle. So the bottom line is that you get that the lifetime for pi goes to mu nu bar satisfies, it's equal to G Fermi squared. I should really have written here, let me write G Fermi hat. G Fermi hat, it turns out it's G Fermi that you measure in the weak interactions times the cosine of what's called the Kabibu angle. But that's something which you can measure. You measure that in neutron decays. So we'll get G Fermi hat squared times F squared. We get F squared because the amplitude is proportional to F, and we square it to get the rate. And we get the mass of the muon squared, mass of the pion, divided by 4 pi times 1 minus mu squared over m pi squared squared. So that's everything you know here except for f, and you measure this, and so you learn what f is, and it turns out that this implies the lifetime of a pion is about 10 to the minus 8 seconds. And so you put in all the numbers here, and you get that that f is 93 or something, 92 MeV. So now the scattering of pions is a prediction. So if I go back here, all these soft pion theorems, they're just absolute predictions that are coming from this measured number from pion decay, and there's no parameters in it. And that's the thing that works so well. And if you really want to know the comparison, these Goldstone and pseudo-Goldstone boson review has a table of the measurements. And it's amazing how well this works. It works well enough that you actually have to do the loop corrections to make the comparison to the experiment. So that was a long-winded way of saying this is a practical process which works really well, and this is kind of where the formalism originally came from. Yep. Right. So to really do this properly, I would add muons and pions. So I'd have L as this plus the muon Lagrangian. And then the muons and pions wouldn't talk to each other, but they'd both talk to electromagnetism, and they'd talk to each other through this term. But the only thing in that whole process which does the decay is this one. So all those other things I'm not writing aren't playing any role. Right. So you know, in the last couple minutes, I hope to get to, so I forgot who it was now, wanted to see the fluid stuff. That was you, right? You guys. So that's what that'll be the topic of the last classes. So the thing that we're trading that for is the non-relativistic stuff. And so let me kind of close with just a hand wave start of how things change in the non-relativistic case. One of which actually comes in right away for there's a trivial thing to say, and there's a kind of a slightly more systematic thing to say. So let me start with the trivial thing. So supposing that we were interested in a system where it wasn't relativistic, we were interested in spin waves or some other Goldstone boson that arises in nature. This story would go through like it did before, but the part about this metric in the target space would go through like before. But what would change is the relativistic symmetry, and so you wouldn't be getting the combination here, which is just the Lorentz invariant combination. In principle, if you're doing this for a solid, let's imagine that we make life simple for ourselves and we don't have some sort of a lattice symmetry, we just have some rotationally invariant material, then the space-time symmetries would change in that they wouldn't be Lorentz invariant, but they would be rotationally invariant, say, and possibly translation invariant. So in that case, so the topic here is how things differ in non-relativistic situations. And I'm going to start with just a very trivial statement, and that is that the space-time symmetries of L get replaced by whatever the new ones are. Say rotational invariance, if you have it, translations, as appropriate. So in this story I told you, if we've been talking about anti-ferromagnets, say, where, so let's take the case of an anti-ferromagnet, so the case where you have spins that all like to anti-align. Say we do that in three dimensions or something. So we have that kind of a lattice, then that's breaking some of the symmetries of the problem. In particular, it's breaking the rotational invariance. And so there will be a Goldstone particle corresponding to the fact you've broken rotation invariance, and that's going to be a spin wave. So, and in this case, you can think of the symmetry being broken is the original symmetry was rotation, so that's SO3. And the unbroken symmetry is the one that rotates you along the direction of the line spins. And that would be SO2. So the symmetry breaking pattern here would be SO3 breaks to SO2, which is that is the two-sphere. That's the space we're talking about is the sphere. So this defines a breaking G to H, where G is SO3, that's rotations in space, and H is SO2, which is rotations around the unbroken axis. And anti-ferromagnets have the property that they differ from ferromagnets, where the spins are all lining up the same way, in that they preserve time reversal invariance. Whereas if all the spins lined up, the order parameter here is it's a sum of alternating spins, and so that if you flip the direction of time reversal, the spins all change direction, but for an anti-ferromagnet, you don't care because they were alternating anyway. If we had them all pointing the same direction, we flip t goes to minus t and all the spins flip the direction, and that's actually different. And so the way you think about a ferromagnet and an anti-ferromagnet are different. This one's easier because time reversal is one of the symmetries you'd keep. So we would do the same story here, yada, yada, yada. We're trying to find the Goldstone boson thing that describes the propagation of the spin waves for an anti-ferromagnet. And what we'll find is it'll be some metric with some coefficient times GAB. And then we'll have the derivatives. But the derivatives, the space and time derivatives, don't have to be related to each other. So we'd have something like theta dot A, theta dot B. And then we'd have another, let's call that F time. We have F space squared over 2 GAB times grad theta A dot grad theta B. Where in this case, A and B are running from 1 to 2 because there's 3 generators here, 1 generator here, so there's 2 broken generators. And this has to be the invariant metric for that space. And since it's a sphere, and we all grew up knowing what the invariant metric on a sphere is, we can just write it down. It'll be minus FT squared over 2. So we'll have theta dot squared. I'm gonna say theta 1, I'm going to call theta. Theta 2, I'm going to call phi. And I'm going to use polar coordinates in the sphere. So I have theta dot squared plus sine squared theta phi dot squared. And minus, I have plus this, I guess, for time derivatives. Minus F space squared over 2 grad theta dot grad theta plus sine squared theta grad phi dot grad phi plus so on. And so we got 2 parameters rather than 1 because we no longer have a Lorentz invariance saying that time and space are related to each other is what's happening. I'm assuming we have rotational invariance to say that they only get that combination. And then you can go to town here and you can ask, what's the energy of a spin wave as a function of its momentum? And that's going to correspond, if we linearized, looked at the quadratic part to start off with, we're going to get the energy squared is proportional to the momentum squared. And so we're going to get something which starts off with a frequency that goes like some number times momentum squared. And that number will be the ratio of Fs and Ft. And that would be the speed of the wave. And so there's not a lot of surprises there, except that you have more terms than you would have had in the Lorentz invariant case. The anti-ferromagnet is a little bit more interesting because it breaks time reversal invariance, you're allowed to write down things with only even numbers of time derivatives, which I could have written down theta dot. The reason I didn't write down something with just one theta dot here was that it would have been allowed by rotational invariance, but it would have been forbidden by time reversal invariance. So if I have an anti-ferromagnet, I can now write something down which is linear in theta dot. And so in that case, the kind of thing I'd have would be, I'd have some coefficient of theta dot, A. So let's call the coefficient AA of theta. I'll put a minus sign there because I think I want to write that. Then we have things like we had before. We have minus F squared over 2 GAB grad theta A dot grad theta B. And so the smallest number of time derivatives now is theta dot. And in the same way that this geometrically is a metric, the condition that we have a symmetry says that we're looking for something which is invariant under the transformations, if I think of delta theta A as being CA of theta, that's a vector on the target space, and then it's a killing vector of the metric on that target space. This is going to have a similar geometrical interpretation, and it looks like it's supposed to be a vector field, and you naively might have said, well, it has to be a vector field defined on a sphere, which is invariant under rotations, and the answer for that problem would have been there are none. There's no way you can comb us. You can't comb the hair of a sphere. So there are no invariant vector fields in a sphere. So you might have thought that this is actually forbidden by the symmetries, and that would be a puzzle because this term really is there for anti-ferromagnetic waves. And the resolution of what's going on there, so we're looking for something naively, which is an invariant vector field, but the reason that that's wrong is that we don't have to demand the Lagrangian be invariant, we only have to demand the action be invariant. So this only has to be invariant up to a total derivative. So what we're asking is that if it was true that the transformation of A, so delta A, if that were the derivative of something for some omega, then what would happen here is that we'd end up with the variation of L would be theta dot A times the derivative A of omega. And that's just d dt of omega by the chain rule. I differentiate the theta, and then I differentiate theta. And so if I stick this in the Lagrangian, if I integrate it over time, I'm going to get something which is a total derivative. So that actually would be a symmetry. So we don't have to ask that A be an invariant vector. We only have to ask that A be invariant up to the shifting of a gradient, and that reminds you of something. So A doesn't have to be an invariant vector. It has to be an invariant gauge field, and it's invariant up to a gauge transformation. So we want A of theta must be invariant up to a gauge transformation. And the way to solve that problem is we just calculate the field strength for A and ask it to be invariant. So then we're asking for an FAB, an invariant 2x2 antisymmetric matrix on the sphere. And that's actually easy to write down. That's the volume form on the sphere. So so what we ask is that we ask for this to be invariant. And that does have a solution. So FAB is proportional to the antisymmetric tensor. And that says that A is then a calculable thing. It's like 1 minus cosine theta. Implies a non-zero A. And the implications of this first derivative term are that the energy of a spin wave and a ferromagnet starts off being something quadratic and p squared. So it's some number times, let's call it k times p squared, and which is different from what it would have been an antiferromagnet. And it's time reversal breaking that's allowing that to happen. The thing I really wanted to say, I probably shouldn't start now because that'll just get us keep us going for a while. But the story here, what's missing in this non-relativistic story so far, is the power counting argument. And so what's happening here is, in a case like this where we have one time derivative. And two space derivatives, we have to rethink the way we did the scaling of the fields. Right, when we were deciding what terms were big and small, we did a dimensional analysis argument where we tracked the behavior of how fields, what the dimension of all the interactions were, and we did that under the assumption that the kinetic term was not had no dimensionful coefficients in front of it, because we assumed that that was dominating the path integral. And the thing to do now in the non-relativistic case would be to do that again, but we have to rethink it a little bit, because now we would be expecting these two things to dominate in the path integral if the things are not if they're not interacting very strongly. And that means that time and space derivatives are going to count a little bit differently than they did before. So we'll either pick that up a little bit in the next class or not. I'm not quite sure. I'm not going to be here next class. So it's Matt Williams is going to do it. And so he's thinking of heading towards the fluids. But I might ask him if he has time to mention this. But it's basically the same argument I gave you before, where you take the thing which is going to dominate and you ask it to dominate the path integral, and things then scale differently. And rather than having all space and time get small at the same time, what's happening is that time and space are getting smaller in different ways because the energy is of the order of the momentum squared. And so the energy is kind of, if the momentum is getting smaller by some factor lambda, the energy should be getting smaller by some factor lambda squared for the regime of interest of the kinds of physics processes you're going to look at, like the scattering of Goldstone bosons at low energies. So this is the tip of an iceberg, but I should probably leave it at that. Any questions? Sorry for running late. Are you guys good in York?
Yeah.